Good afternoon. And thank you for joining us today for the release of Open Science by Design, Realizing a Vision for 21st Century Research, a new report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. I'm Sarah Free from the news office here at the Academies, and I'd like to welcome both those of you here in the room and those attending via Zoom. And I'd like to invite, if anyone who's sitting along the periphery would like to sit up at the table, please do so. It will make it easier if you have questions later. You'll have a microphone. The report is now available, and it can be downloaded as a free PDF at www.nap.edu. For those of you not familiar with the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, we are private nonprofit institutions that provide independent, objective analysis and advice to the United States to solve complex problems and inform public policy decisions related to science, technology, and medicine. The academies operate under a congressional charter to the National Academy of Sciences that was signed by President Lincoln in 1863. For each requested study, committee members are chosen for their expertise and experience and serve pro bono to carry out the study's statement of task. The reports that result from the study represent the consensus view of the committee and must undergo external peer review before they are released, as did this report. Today with us, we have the chair of the study committee that wrote the report, Dr. Alexa McCray, who is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. McCray will offer an overview of the report's findings and recommendations. After that, she and committee member Michael Carroll, who is a professor of law at American University, will take any questions you may have. Those attending remotely can email in their questions to the email address provided. First, though, I'd like to welcome to the podium Dr. Marcia McNutt, president of the National Academy of Sciences, who will offer some opening remarks.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, although I suppose it's probably good morning for some of you out there in web land. So, in thinking about what to say to you all today, I was thinking back over the vast arc of human history and thinking to myself that there have only been a few notable milestones in the purposeful sharing of information. The first clearly happened when early humans developed language. It then became possible to share more than simple wants and needs, but instead complicated plans and abstract thoughts and desires, E equals MC squared, which would never before have been possible. The second milestone I would put on my list is the development of written language. Now the sharing of information no longer needed to rely on oral tradition, but instead could be recorded for posterity. Over the millennia, advances in technologies, beginning with clay tablets and papyrus, and advancing to the printing press, the typewriter, the word processor, and the ubiquitous personal computer, the sharing of information through the written word was accelerated. The third milestone that I put on my list of information sharing is the creation of libraries. Built in the third century BC, the Library of Alexandria was the largest and most significant library of the ancient world, and its descendant still stands today as a testament to the foresight of those ancient scholars. Next on my list, I put the creation of the research journal. In 1665, Phil Trans of the Royal Society of London became the first periodical that was publishing scientific works in recognition of the need to disseminate the results of research to other scientists on a periodic basis. Henry Oldenburg was the Royal Society's first secretary. He published Phil Trans out of his own pocket and was allowed to keep the profits from publishing Phil Trans, and out of that, he covered the rent on his house in Piccadilly. Now, this model of publishing for profit is the one we still use today. And other than expanding and going digital, this model has not much changed up until the present. And here today we stand at the inflection point of what I propose will be the fifth milestone in the sharing of information, the open information revolution. Today, the National Academies releases an important report, Open Science by Design, Realizing a Vision for 21st Century Research. But open science isn't going to happen just because a National Academies report says it's a good thing to do. We have to change the culture within the research community so that open science becomes the easy, the accepted, and the default path of least resistance. This report lays out the roadmap for achieving that goal. It will require the combined efforts of many stakeholders, including funders, universities, journals, and scientific societies, to change the culture and to reward the right behaviors. It will require development of technologies, just as sharing by print did, to grease the paths of least resistance. Most of all, it will require leadership, just like Ptolemy I in the 3rd century BC, or the Royal Society in 1665. Of course, there will have to be exceptions. Some parts of the research enterprise may not be open for legitimate concerns related to patient confidentiality, national security, or other reasons. I note an interesting coincidence that as we are rolling out this report here, the National Academies have weighed in on the proposed EPA rule being discussed at another meeting across town that would preclude regulatory actions unless the underlying data are all in the public domain. Many critical decisions that bear on human health, safety, and national security can be made reliably using information that must be kept confidential for accepted reasons. In closing, I'd like to thank and congratulate the study chair, Alexa McCray, and the rest of her committee for undertaking the study. I'd also like to thank the Laura and John Arnold Foundation for their leadership in sponsoring this study. Finally, I'd like to thank all of you who are joining us today, both in person and virtually. Many of you are responsible for addressing the issues raised in the report. Some of you will be those leaders who will carry the torch and ensure the legacy for this fifth milestone in information sharing. No pressure. Now, with that, I'd like to turn the podium over to Alexa.
Thank you very much, Marcia. And I'd like to welcome everyone again, those who are in the room and those who are joining us virtually. We will be talking about the report that has just been released, Open Science by Design. And this is a consensus study report that was overseen by BERDI, so-called BERDI, the Board on Research Data and Information, which is a part of the Policy and Global Affairs Division here at the National Academies. And the study sponsor, as has already been mentioned, Laura and John Arnold Foundation, whom we thank. The committee consisted of the chair, myself, Francine Berman from RPI, Michael Carroll, who was able to join us today in the room, from the American University American University College of Law, Donna Ginthard from the University of Kansas, Robert Miller from Lyrisis, Peter Schiffer from Yale University, Ed Seidel from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Alex Salazy from the Johns Hopkins University, Lisa Tauchs from the University of California, San Diego, and Hung Zhu from the Pennsylvania State University. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank the outstanding staff at the National Academies for all the many hours of work that they've put into this report, and to thank the reviewers. We had quite a few reviewers of this report, and we had those who oversaw the review process. All of those folks made a big difference to the final report that you have in front of you today. So I thank them very much as well. Well, what is open science? We've talked about it. What is a good definition for open science? Well, open science aims to ensure the open availability and usability of scholarly publications. And I think we'll emphasize the usability, because it isn't just access to the information, but the ability to use it and to reuse it that is critical here. And it's not just the publications themselves, but the data that result from scholarly research, the methodologies, and very importantly, in today's world, the code or the algorithms that were used to generate those results. So the code and algorithms are very important for the interpretation of the raw data that you might have collected in your studies. The committee would like to make the point that openness and sharing of information are fundamental to the progress of science and to the effective functioning of the research enterprise. We were given a statement of task by the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, and that statement said we needed to identify and address the challenges of broadening access to the results of scientific research. And we were to focus on how to move toward open science as the default for scientific research results, with specific recommendations to implement it. I might note that we were not asked to assess whether open science was good or whether it was bad, but rather, given the task here, it was to say, well, how do we get to open science as the default going forward? We were asked to identify the barriers to, as well as the facilitators of open science. And most importantly, we were asked to make recommendations for solutions in across a range of areas. So there are policy solutions, there are the solutions around infrastructure. What kind of infrastructure do we need? Dr. McNutt referred to new tools, new kinds of infrastructure that we might need to realize this vision. And the incentives and requirements to facilitate open science. So that speaks to the culture of science, of how science is being done today, and what are the appropriate incentives for the scientists and other researchers. We were asked to provide specific policy and practice options for federal science agencies to move forward, have open science be the default. How did we actually doing this study? The process involved several meetings. The first two meetings, we were gathering data and information. The first meeting, the afternoon of that meeting was an open session, a public session, where we heard from a variety of folks who have been involved in open science, in reproducibility issues, in providing guidance to the community about how to get to open science. Then the second meeting, we had a full-day symposium where we invited stakeholders from the broader community in all areas of who would be affected by and who have been involved in science and open science. Then the next couple of meetings held in the fall and in the winter of fall of 2017, the winter of 2018. We were writing, and finally we had a number of virtual meetings going into the spring where we discussed items regarding finalizing the report. So that's the study process. It's not an unusual process. This is the process that is generally followed in academy reports. So some of the benefits and motivations for open science that the committee enumerated were improvements to rigor and reliability. We've also already talked about having data, for example, available so that studies can be reproduced. The ability to address new questions. So if you, the data and publications are openly available across disciplines, you may well be able to, as someone working in one discipline, be able to look at results, research results in other disciplines that inform and broaden your approach to the science that you're doing. Faster and more inclusive dissemination of knowledge, opportunity to collaborate with others, whether it's within your discipline or across discipline. Broader participation in research, and here this is a question of not only having people within the sciences participate in research, but perhaps also citizens out there in the broader world. There's a nice example from the Sloan Digital Sky survey, where the data were openly available right from the start. And there was a project called Galaxy Zoo, where the data were made openly available for students, for teachers to be able to actually make discoveries. And there is an example of a teacher who made a discovery of a new celestial body, which is something that would not have been possible had the data not been openly available. There's the effective use of resources so that, for example, in healthcare, if you're doing a clinical trial, and the Academy actually had a report on sharing clinical trial data, if you're doing a clinical trial and you've done it once, and let's say the results were negative, and so maybe you didn't publish about that, the problem with something like that is that somebody else might do a clinical trial, that same clinical trial or a very similar clinical trial, putting perhaps more individuals at risk if they had not been aware that there already was a study that was done. Improved performance of research tasks, and this is where this actually is sort of a forward pointer to the recommendations that we as a committee made in the report, is that there, if there are tools for doing your research in an open way, then it makes it much easier for a researcher to participate. And then open publication for public benefit, whether this is because the research that you've done has been funded by taxpayer dollars, that's one good reason to make your research openly available, and there are many other potential public benefits. So those are some of the benefits that we listed and discussed in the report. But we as a committee were also aware of the fact that there are barriers, that there are challenges to open science, to achieving open science. There are cost issues, there are infrastructure issues, as I've already mentioned, the structure of how scholarly communications are being done today and what might be needed to shift that to greater openness. The culture itself, the culture of research, of academia, and perhaps where we are lacking incentives for scientists to be engaged in making their research more openly available. Importantly, we noted that we need to look at training right from the start, whether you're training graduate students, postgraduate students, about how to even do open science, what it means, what the benefits, maybe what some of the challenges are. So there's some recommendations in that regard. We've already talked a little bit, Dr. McNutt talked a little bit about privacy, security, and proprietary barriers to sharing. We consider that to be somewhat out of scope of our study. We alluded to it, but there are certainly some issues there. And then, of course, there are disciplinary differences. There are some disciplines that are open, have been open perhaps even from the start. And again, the area of genomic studies, Human Genome Project, was open right from the start. Other disciplines are moving in that direction, but there are indeed disciplinary differences. There are very large efforts to collect data that are meant to be openly available to the community from the start. There's what is sometimes referred to as the long tail of science, which are individual researchers who are working in their labs, and there will be differences in how we handle the the issue of making the data and the, perhaps the publications openly available. As Dr. McNutt said, we are at an inflection point. We have quite a few information technology tools and services that we can harness. We need to develop more, but we can harness those. There have been quite a few mandates by not only federal sponsors, but also increasingly by research funders, by other research funders. So there are policies that have been put in place, but not just policies. In some cases, support systems have been created. For example, Wellcome Trust, the European Commission, the Gates Foundation have created infrastructure and support systems that ease the task of making the data, for example, that results from the research more openly available. Quite a few publishers are adopting open frameworks and strengthening the requirements to ensure that data and methods underlying the articles are available. So you'll know, those of you who are scientists and who publish know that many journals now are requiring that at the time of publication, you as a scientist also make your data openly available, as well as the code and so on, the data that underlie the study that you've done. The federal agencies, as many of you are aware, have developed and implemented policies based on the memoranda from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the 2013 memorandum, the so-called Holdren Memo, which was primarily around publications and data in digital form and making those openly available, and then the 2014 memorandum that that addressed the question of physical specimens. And these are not digital objects, these are physical specimens, but in fact there are metadata that are associated with those physical objects, that and that there are methods whereby you are then able to find the location of those, not only find the location of those specimens, but also have a plan for preserving for the long term those very valuable resources. So as a committee, we came up with the concept of open science by design. And the important thing here to note is that the researcher is at the center of all of this. What do we mean by open science by design? It's a set of principles and practices that fosters openness throughout the entire research life cycle. So the way you might think about this is that, you know, today it is often the case that because of various mandates and data management plans and so on, it's only at the end of the study that the researcher says, oops, I forgot to, you know, get my data and my everything in order so that I could share those data. I didn't assign any metadata, and now I have to go back and do that, and now my project is over and I'm on to the next thing. So the idea of open science by design is that really openness of research result, making your research results open at the end of a project, is a byproduct of the way that you have done your research all along. So if you see this this image that that we have come up with, it actually relates to the various aspects, and I'll go into each of them in turn, the various aspects of how research is done, and the fact that at every point, you can have tools and resources that make it possible for you to make your data, your results, and so forth openly available at the time that you are ready to do so. So if you think about the first step in this vision and this view of open science by design, is that you may use, for example, public databases or other resources that are now openly available, because more and more data and information will be openly available. You can mine those open resources, research resources, using the latest artificial intelligence techniques, machine learning, and so on. But you can only do that if the data are available, the research results are available, and you're able to search across them and mine different parts of those resources. that might be the first step. You start thinking about what it is that you are going to do. You might network with colleagues. Increasingly, many, many studies are not just an individual scientist sitting at a lab bench, but actually a collaboration among multiple scientists. Then you get to the point where you're developing and revising your research plan. You probably ask for funding. You write up your specific aims. You apply to a federal agency or a private funder, and you think about how you are going to be sharing your research results at the end when you're ready. But that's all part of what now has become called your data management plan. And we've noted here, and this is something that is discussed quite a lot in the research community right now, is that these databases, and particularly these large data sets, that the data need to be available under so-called FAIR principles. So findable, that the data are findable either through metadata, through harvesting engines, and so on, that they're accessible, that anybody can have access, that they're interoperable, much harder to do because you need to, we need more sort of semantic interoperability tools, and importantly, that they are reusable. I've already talked about that with regards to not just reproducibility, but the ability to actually effectively use all of those resources that are now available. So that's at the, at the beginning, you're putting your project together and so on. Now you go forward and you collect your data. And wouldn't it be ideal if you could collect your data with tools that allow you to curate just as you're doing your research, you're curating your data so that you're tagging your data, for example. Then they are automated workflow tools to ensure accessibility. So there are electronic notebooks, for example, that many people are using. There are a variety of other tools, and more surely will be in development. Then at the point where you are ready to perhaps get some further input from the broader community, you might put an initial paper onto a preprint server so that you get comments and review comments from your broader community, and the idea being that you can improve your research as part of doing that. It's also a way of ensuring greater accountability in how science is being done. Now you're ready for the dissemination phase. And dissemination phase, it's very important to use appropriate licenses so that you, as the researcher, remember the researcher is at the center of open science by design, that you make known to the world how you would like your publication, your data, and so on to be used, that you are in a position to do that. And then finally, when you're all done, make sure that you deposit your research outputs in FAIR archives to ensure the long-term access. Well, how are we going to get there? It all sounds great, perhaps, maybe, but how are we going to get there? It was going to require persistent and coordinated action on the part of the entire research enterprise and their stakeholders. We developed, as usual, with a consensus study, findings, recommendations, and implementation actions, not only based on all of the testimony that we heard from various stakeholders, but by a very careful review of the literature in scholarly communication. First recommendation regards building a supportive culture. So our finding is the continued effort by stakeholders working internationally and across disciplinary boundaries, even though we focused on the United States, but we recognize that this is really a global issue. But our focus, of course, in our report was on the U.S. So we need combined effort to change evaluation practices and introduce other incentives so the cultural environment of research better supports and rewards open practices. So the recommendation based on this actually set of findings is that research institutions should work to create a culture that actively supports open science by design, by better rewarding and supporting researchers engaged in open science practices. And research funders should provide explicit and consistent support for practices and approaches that facilitate this shift. So what do we mean by that? So today, for example, in the academic culture, there is a reward system, a promotion and tenure system that is often based on metrics, on bibliometric indicators that indicate that a particular journal, for example, has a particular impact factor, and that the journal that you might publish in. It turns out that there are other ways that we are recommending that there are other ways of recognizing contributions to the research. So perhaps the person or the persons who collected the data, the individuals who wrote the code, and the algorithms for interpreting the data, and that all of these are valid ways of getting credit for the work that you as an individual researcher have done. And that the research funder is providing consistent support. We've already talked about perhaps frameworks, helping people, policies, and other ways of getting to open science by design. So that's the first set of recommendations around building a supportive culture in science. Training for open science by design. So there's very little formal training today and education in the principles and practices of open science. It's important to note that the emergence of data science as a recognized interdisciplinary field really has highlighted the need for new educational content. There is, in fact, a very recent Academy report on undergraduate education in data science. And there is further work on going forward to graduate school and postgraduate education and training today's researchers. So that recommendation then is that research institutions as well as professional societies should train students and other researchers to implement open science practices effectively and should support the development of educational programs. And there's a role for the private sector here as well to create educational resources that are dependent on, that are useful for training. The third area is ensuring long-term preservation and stewardship, which I've already alluded to. Developing and sustaining the infrastructure that's required for long-term stewardship. This will present a continuing challenge. It's not just the financial challenge, but other challenges as well. The recommendation is that research funders and research institutions should develop the policies and procedures to identify the data codes, specimens, and other research products that should be preserved. So in other words, and provide the resources necessary. So it may not be the case that every bit of the research, you know, that you've done, all of those interim research products, they may not be the ones that make it into the final data that are shared. But this is something that the community needs to decide on, is how do we best select what should be shared and what shouldn't. And of course, librarians, and Dr. McNutt already talked about the importance of libraries. Librarians are, this is what they do. They select, they manage, they curate. These are all the kinds of things that we need to do in a broader way. So that was the third recommendation. The fourth one is around facilitating data discovery, reuse, and reproducibility. So as progress towards open science by design continues, the community will need to adhere to the ultimate goal of achieving the availability of research products under open principles. So recommendation four says that funders that support the development of research archives should work to ensure that these are designed and implemented according to the FAIR data principles. So remember, findable, accessible, interoperable and reusable. So those resources are developed and implemented according to those principles. Researchers should seek to ensure that their products are made available in FAIR databases. And if for any reason researchers are not able to share in these repositories, then they need to state with specificity any exceptions based on legal and ethical considerations. So might be things like patient privacy and so on. But that would all be part of your initial data management plan as you are talking about what will be shareable and what for those areas where it might not be possible to share. And then finally, developing new approaches to fostering open science by design. The finding is that public and private funders have made significant contributions to fostering open science at this point. The recommendation of the committee is that they should continue to support initiatives that accelerate progress and evaluate and revise their policies as needed. So finally, then, the recommendation is the research community, that is all members of the research community, should work together to realize open science by design to advance science and help science better serve the needs of society. So those are the five major recommendations that we have. When you see the report, which you've just gotten access to, you'll see that we have lists of findings, additional findings, as well as very specific implementation actions that accompany each one of these recommendations. So just to wrap up, and again, this harkens back to Dr. McNutt's remarks at the beginning, openness and sharing of information are fundamental to the progress of science and to the effective functioning of the research enterprise. You might even say that the digital revolution is, you know, that really open science is a natural consequence of the digital revolution, because it's almost not possible to do science today without actually doing it in an open and digital framework. So open science by design is a framework that empowers the researcher to conduct research openly and transparently throughout every phase of the research process. And of course, there's still more to be done to support the principles and practices of open science by design. So I think I will now turn this over to Sarah Free, who will moderate the questions and discussion.
Thank you. Okay, and I'd like to invite Dr. McCray and Mr. Carroll to please sit up here so everyone can see you.
This is just so I remember who I am.
Yeah. On both we don't
sides.
Make you
No, we don't make you
And just so we can kind of do this in an organized way, if you have a question, if you could raise your hand and I'll call on you to make sure we're not multiple people speaking at once. And also we would ask you to please use the microphone in front of you. Just hit the button. I can't remember whether it's a red or a green one. Green, and then the red light should go on at the top of your microphone. And then please say your name and your affiliation and ask your question. If you are sitting along the wall, please raise your hand and a colleague of mine will bring you a handheld mic. And those online, I think an email address has been provided you. You can email in your questions. So, Dr. McNutt.
Well, this question is for either of you. Given that your committee met for a long time and had lots of opportunities to brainstorm things that may not have even made it into the report, if you could come up with one outstanding action that one organization could undertake that might really be an accelerator for open science, what would that action be, and who would that actor be?
Okay, if it's fair, I'm going to do one, and Michael can do another one, if that's fair. I think that one very, very important action would be for the research community, academia itself, to take some action here, so that it goes to our first recommendation, which is the culture of science. And given that we are living in a digital world, given that so much has changed in the last 20 years, I mean, if you think that, you know, in the mid to late 90s, our world changed. Academia didn't change that much. And so taking that into account, you know, the provost at the university, the department chairs, recognizing how important it is to promote, and I mean promote in the broader sense now, early career investigators to say, well, this is the way that science is being done today. And by the way, we're going to reward you for that. I think that would be fabulous. I guess that's my opinion. Although, in fact, I was told very specifically not to give my own opinions, but this is really the opinion. You asked my opinion. But these are the kinds of things that we were discussing in our committee, and really I would say, based on the existing evidence of how the world of science is changing today. So, Michael, I'm going to give you the answer.
It's a great question, and thank you for the opening remarks. That was great. I mean, wow, the fifth millennium of that was great. I don't know that it's an action, because we're talking about culture change, and so no one actor, I think, can change the whole culture. But part of what the title of the report is trying to do, I think, is provide a meme, a shorthand. And what I would love to see is in each of the stakeholder institutions, if people start to push on this idea of how is this open by design? So if a new grant, if you're going to open up a new line of funding for research and you put out the RFP, somebody inside the organization has to say, how is this open by design? In what ways are we planning on the research outputs that we're about to fund, making sure that those are open? And similarly, in the research institutions, in what ways are you planning for openness in the way you conduct your research? If we can get that idea across.
So, for example, NSF has their various criteria. One is the, you know, intrinsic merit of the proposal, and the other is the broader impacts. What if they had a third, which was, and the third criteria is the degree to which the PI group has designed openness into the project at the various phases of it. I mean, I think that would
absolutely
change the culture.
And I would just generalize that to say all federal agencies, but actually all research funders would be able to do that. So absolutely.
Okay. Sorry, you had here.
Thanks. Mike Hurta with the National Library of Medicine at NIH. We've been asked to take the lead on open science for NIH, and so we think a lot about these things. And there's a tension between kind of trying to make this happen across the whole universe for us, biomedical science, versus where it might not be taken up. And on one of your points was disciplinary differences, I think is what it was called. Did the committee give any thought to identifying domains, however you would define that, maybe around a particular project like all of us, or maybe a particular disciplinary domain that appears poised and ready to adopt open science approaches, and then work with the major actors in that part of the enterprise, including maybe major universities that have a concentration in those disciplines, again, depending on how you define this, maybe some of the major journals, some of the major funding institutes, private and public, and try to actually bring a group together to identify how they can align incentives so that they're mutually reinforcing. So in other words, you're kind of directing it in a particular area, as opposed to trying to get everybody that does science to adopt these things.
So we did. We didn't do exactly. The committee didn't do exactly what you said, but we were charged with looking at disciplinary differences, as I noted. One of our findings or recommendations was that this really needs to be community driven. So we didn't identify a particular community, but we saw examples, especially in our open session, which I believe you attended in September, where we had the American Geophysical Society, for example, a large group of individuals that have subdisciplines, just like biomedicine has subdisciplines, and the activities that they are undertaking. So yes, there are, you know, funder pressures and mandates and so on, but there also are quite a few community-driven initiatives, and that may be a place where, and again, we didn't address exactly what you are asking, but even looking at some of the examples where we talked about different areas, we looked at economics, for example, which has a very long tradition of making their working papers openly available. In physics, you have the archive, which once again, you know, there are preprints that are made openly available and still published in standard journals. So there were examples like that, but yes, that's certainly something that you as an at NIH would be in a position to do.
So I'm Heather Joseph from SPARC. Thank you guys for the work that you did on this report. I can't wait to read the final version. Dr. McNutt, thank you for the shout out to libraries at the beginning. We certainly feel like we play an important role. I love the gracefulness of the phrase open science by design. We have been using a little bit of a clumsier way to get at the need to change the culture to make open the default by saying openness needs to be baked in, not bolted on at the end. Open by design, I think, is a little bit more elegant and maybe user-friendly, shall we say. The two areas that I'm also really thrilled to see the emphasis is obviously on incentivizing researchers to think about making open the default from the beginning. But the training piece really intrigues me, and I'm curious, having not seen the final recommendations, where in particular are early career researchers, where the committee may have identified opportunities to reach them in the training process of open science is really how you do good science. Are there ways that we can work with our academic institutions, onboarding new students in trainings with using libraries? You know, these are open resources. Are there actions that the committee has identified that we could play an active role in supporting in that arena?
Absolutely, and we did discuss that. We do have a couple of sections in the report about training. One area that we talked about, again, relates to funders who could require, so for example, I'm a principal investigator of a training grant from NIH, and NSF has many training grants that they award, and other agencies do as well, that just like they make responsible conduct of research a part of something that you are required to do and should embrace actually doing, one of the recommendations around training says that perhaps this could be written into some of the requirements for training grants. That would be one example. There are groups in Europe, specifically the Foster Initiative, that is looking at providing training materials. There is an initiative at Berkeley for social science training. One thing that I think, you know, there is an opportunity, and I think I mentioned it, for the private sector here is sort of building on the fact that there is that there's open data out there, that there are open resources, is perhaps, in addition to using those resources, perhaps working on creating some very interesting training tools, you know, online training tools and that sort of thing. So we talked a little bit about that. But yes, there certainly is an opportunity there. We did not go into great depth, but we did mention the very important role of librarians particularly in facilitating the training of even mid-career scientists who are, and also including this as orientation in their orientation to the library, for example. And it's really to the library broadly understood. So we did talk about it some, yes.
Mark Elsesser, the American Physical Society. I noticed in your barriers and challenges, one of the points you made is the structure of scholarly communications and the impact that, you know, open science could have on publishers and researchers at various universities. I'm just wondering to what extent during the process you reached out to individual PIs, you know, across the country who could be impacted and the nonprofit publishers.
Well, so we didn't actually reach out, and the reaching out that we did was with regards to having a stakeholder meeting in September. So that, but we certainly did reach into the literature, and there are many surveys, for example, that have been done recently of researchers' attitudes and approaches to their understanding of openness. And of course, it ranges, you know, the gamut of open versus closed. One of the comments that's often made in response to these surveys is that we are endangering the young early career investigators. And again, it's incumbent upon the senior investigators to protect that, to protect the younger investigators. So, so that's how we approached it. Thank you.
Just one other thing about, I think part of our job in the report was to articulate a coherent vision of this is what we could have. Now that we have these technologies for community, as you said, to share information, this is what it could look like if it were open by design. And then the barriers and limitations are about recognizing why we are where we are, why we aren't already at that point. And in the public sessions, we did have representatives from a variety of publishers, both for-profit and nonprofit. And you'll see that the report identifies and responds to the concerns that we've heard. But it is important to sort of hold out that vision of what's possible and then say, how do all the stakeholders find ways to work together to make that a sustainable and realistic vision that is achievable.
Let's go over here.
Thank you very much. My name is Mary Kavanagh, and I'm from the European Union delegation here in Washington, D.C. And as you mentioned, the European Union is working very hard on open science. All of our European Union level research funding is all of the projects, well, with a few exceptions, have to commit to open science publishing openly. And we're developing the European Open Science Cloud. You're probably familiar with, we had a great event at the Wilson Center with several of the people here present were there. My question isn't about that. My question, I just had to do a little bit of publicity.
But thank you
there.
For the brief review. And in fact, we do acknowledge those efforts in the report.
Great. My question is perhaps a little bit different and refers back to something that Dr. McNutt alluded to in her opening statement, and that is the transparency rule that the EPA is proposing. And my question is, do you think that this move towards open science and the recognition of the importance of open science in the way that you are presenting it and the way that we're presenting it in Europe, but in particular in your case, that this will help to alleviate some of the concerns that perhaps are driving in some people's minds issue initiatives such as the transparency rule? Do you think that the move towards open science will help?
So again, the EPA ruling that you discuss was really out of scope for, and was happening just as we were doing our report. It was out of scope. But the broader question of it's with any transitional period, it is important to make sure that what you are proposing is at least as good as where you came from, and we hope better. So we have to keep that in mind. That doesn't mean to say that because, let's say, on a particular day, all of a sudden everything is openly available, as might be the case with everything that was funded within the European Union, that what has come before is no longer useful and important. I think that's very important to keep in mind, is that there is very good science that has been done that has been closed for various reasons, and the culture of science and all the things that we talked about. That doesn't mean that those scientists scientific findings are no longer important. Of course they are. But going forward from this day, it reminds me of the days of the digital libraries, you know, digital library funding and initiatives was that basically everybody said, well, how can we possibly do this? Because we're going to have to digitize millennia worth of, you know, of paper or papyrus or anything that was done. No, basically the idea is you look forward and from this day or this era forward, but that doesn't mean you ignore everything that's come before.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
So, Brooks Hansen, American Geophysical Union. First, I want to echo what Heather said about commending you for the study and the thoughtfulness that went in there, and the, you know, diverse perspectives across science that were part of this, and for the conclusions on FAIR data and other things. So, something we're working on. But my question is on or probing you or asking you for your comments, particularly on recommendation 3 and the common assumption, presumption, conflation of open with free. I say that just visiting Yosemite National Park, which is open and taxpayer funded, but you'll find that it's not free if you actually go there. But on the recommendation where researchers and research funders and research institutions should provide the resources necessary for the long-term preservation, is that implicitly ruling out other, supporting repositories is kind of the key unfunded, uncurrently funded question within this, one of the current unfunded challenges within this framework. So is that implicitly ruling out other funding models that might be user fees or other kind of, I'm just curious on that, how that was discussed and resolved in there as it led to that recommendation.
I wouldn't say that it was resolved. I think it was left as something that the community needs to work out. We did make some, we did some study and we made some comments about the potential for research funders at the very start to ensure that there is appropriate funding for, let's say, for the individual researcher to do what the mandate says that they need to do. So that's one aspect of it. In the report, we did talk about sort of short-term and longer-term approaches to transitioning. And by short-term, we more or less meant immediate. Longer term, we really more or less meant the next 5 years. That's not really long term, but that there will have to be some readjustment. There's already quite a lot of money in the scholarly communication system. There may be some redistribution. We laid out some possibilities for how you get from the point where we are now to how we get to the future. Perhaps desired state as we've elucidated it. So thank you.
Yes, thank you for this piece of work, Ann Bowser from the Wilson Center. I'm very excited to read it. I also appreciated the discussion and especially the policy context that you set, referencing 2013 Holdren memos and OMB as well, 2014 on specimens. In 2015, there was also a critical memo on accelerating research and addressing social needs through crowdsourcing and citizen science. Although I was a little bit dismayed during the last administration that there seemed to be silos between open science and citizen science approaches, I was very excited to see citizen science featured in this report, and thank you for your discussion of Galaxy Zoo. But as you consider openness by design, which is a very holistic approach, I'm wondering also how this applies to open science and citizen science together. Do you see these as linked throughout the open science process, or is citizen science really a component just of broader participation in research? And then how do we link these two paradigms moving forward?
Yeah, I actually, in our report, we did not distinguish citizen science as being something separate from open science. It's a consequence. That now individuals are able to, out in the world, are able to do science and have access to scientific results to which they did not have access before. So no, I do not see those as in the report, and the committee did not see those as separate things. I might also point out that there were two other Academy studies recently, one on communication of science and one on science literacy, in which I also participated. And in those reports, we talked quite a bit about citizen science and how that can move forward. It is the foundation of citizen science is on open science. So you might look at it that way. Without open science, you can't have citizen science, I would say. Maybe that's too strong a statement, but they are certainly linked, yes.
Okay, it is 2:30, which means we need to conclude the briefing. I would like to thank everybody here and online for joining us. And just a reminder that the report PDF can be downloaded free of charge at nap.edu. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.